Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where is the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast. But we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Namaste, I'm Debina Gupta, and on this edition, we will be heading to India to look at Apple's growth strategy, also talking to the man in charge of fighting Mpox in Africa and an Italian town that has banned people from playing cricket there. We find out why and what it says about the tensions faced by the immigrant community there.
These are peoples, not the slaves. So they have to ensure their fundamental rights.
More on that story in just a moment. Now, first to the important data from the world's second largest economy. Consumer Price Index, that measures prices of food, among other things, in China, rose by not 6% year on year. But the real story actually from there is the Producer Price Index, the prices that domestic producers receive for their goods and services. This also saw a fall of 1.8% year on year, which is the steepest fall in 4 months. Now, this indicates that prices of goods, simply put, is falling over time, a condition experts call as a deflation. But what is deflation and why is it worrying? Rebecca Chung Wilkins, who's a reporter with Bloomberg, joined me from Hong Kong to talk about it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting idea. I mean, essentially, because the rest of the world are seeing rising prices, but in China, we have seen deflation, i.e. things are falling in prices. And now, while typically a little bit of that might be good, if we see it too far, if we fall into this sort of downward price wage spiral, it can mean ultimately that people feel that their salaries are falling. We might see companies moving into this phase where they're cutting costs, cutting salaries, cutting bonuses, trimming the size. We see full-on layoffs. So the worry is that we get into this sort of downward spiral that ultimately means everyone feels and is poorer.
Why is this happening? Because China is a global hub for manufacturing. It has got the population dividend as well. So where is it that the pieces of this puzzle for China's economic growth are missing?
Well, China has really struggled to get its growth coming back after the pandemic. People just have not wanted to spend. And a big, big part of that is the crackdown that we saw in the property market. That essentially saw most people looking at the value of their most expensive and most prized asset falling. And people tend to feel poorer. If you see the house, the value of your house falling, let's say 5, 10, maybe even 40 or 50% in some smaller cities in China, of course, you start to worry more about your financial security. So a big part of this is this very weak consumer confidence. And Beijing so far has been quite hesitant to come in with strong stimulus. So although the data has been relatively weak for quite some time now, we've seen instead these sort of piecemeal attempts to try and boost confidence. We have not seen the sort of big bazooka stimulus that investors sometimes like to talk about.
But you've been talking to a lot of economic experts as you follow the story. What are they thinking? What could be that big bang economic stimulus from the government?
Well, it's really interesting. I think economists and investors alike have quite low expectations. We have seen a wave of economists adjusting their forecasts. In fact, more than sort of two thirds of the economists that we track at Bloomberg, for example, saying that they don't think that China is going to meet that 5% growth target. So we have seen a recalibration of the expectations of how well China is going to do this year. But in terms of what might spur that big, big stimulus, I mean, so far the data itself has not been enough to really dramatically move the needle. But something that some economists have mentioned to me is maybe if we see something that really hurts the potential stability of China. So for example, if we see economic protests, which have already been on the rise, if we see them sort of crescendo into a more coordinated and much more widespread effect. But it should be said, we really haven't seen that bubbling up yet, even though we see this sort of sporadic increase in social unrest linked to labor and wages, as well as property markets and the properties not being delivered on time.
And what are the dangers if China continues on this path for the wider region? Because China's supply chain, for example, are linked with most of the major economies.
Yeah, there's certainly a concern that if China deepens into this deflationary cycle, essentially the power and the confidence of the Chinese consumer will still continue to wane. So we will see less consumption overall, not just within China, but outside as well. We see that already a little bit in, for example, the Chinese tourists. We have not seen them going overseas for international travel in the same way that we did before the coronavirus, for example. So we're actually already seeing some of those signs follow through. The other element too is that as China has sort of tried to revamp its economic model, it's increasingly focused on exports to try and cover up some of that shortfall, to make up for the absence of the weakness that we are seeing from the property market. And that pressure on export pressures other countries because China essentially is seeking to export more to other countries, adding to some of those deficit issues and also adding to some of these complaints about overcapacity that we have seen not just come from Western governments like the US and Canada, but also other countries and developing nations in the so-called global south.
Rebecca Chung from Bloomberg there. I'm also joined by Rachel Winter, investment manager at Click & Company. Rachel, we just heard about the latest data from China. Now, how is it playing on the minds of investors and also those companies looking to diversify their supply chain with the China Plus One model?
Well, deflation is always a concern. So if you're a consumer and you're thinking about buying something, if you expect prices to be lower next year, then you're going to delay your purchase until next year. And that can go on for years or even decades. And it can be very negative for economic growth. That's what we've seen happening in Japan. And I think there is a real concern that the same thing could be happening in China now.
Rachel, stay with me because that question about supply chain is also an important one because as China faces these challenges for its economy, one country that seems to be benefiting from it is India, which is becoming a popular destination for those companies looking to diversify their supply chain. One tech company is Apple, which is making more and more of its iPhones in India. And in just a couple of hours, Apple will launch its new series of iPhones. And the chances are that many of them will be from India. So I earlier caught up with Tarun Pathak, research director at Counterpoint Research, who spoke to me about Apple's growth strategy from Gurgaon in India.
Apple's journey started in 2017-2018 in India, although it's still 6 years old. But it started with the previous generation iPhones, but then it scaled to almost like the Pro versions and even the Pro versions were not being manufactured until lately in India. So this is quite big because For in India, this is a testament to India's position in the global manufacturing landscape that, okay, here is a country that can make as complex devices as iPhone.
What are the advantages that India is offering at this moment? Because traditionally, most of these phones have been manufactured in China.
So there are three advantages. One is like you have a policy level or the regulatory level, like tariff level advantages. So that is one. The second is you have this workforce level advantage. So, for example, if you look at right now, Tim Cook mentioned a couple of years back that, okay, China has long top position itself as a cheap labor, right? It is not. The labor is costlier in China. But if you compare it with someone like India, India can still offer you better advantage. So even look at the quality of the workforce. It's a very young, dynamic country.
But there are several components that India is not able to manufacture and has to get them from outside. Which are those components, and is it also adding to their cost?
Yes. So those components are like, for example, displays, and then you have camera modules, you have memories, and then you have chipsets that contribute to almost like 60% of the phone cost. Basically, there is a concept of semi-knockdown and fully knockdown kits. So what they are doing is they are importing a semi-knockdown and assembling it here in India. So it's not like you have to import 10 different components from different things. You are still importing, but you are importing as a semi-knockdown kit.
And because there are less or no duties on these kits, it is becoming cost-effective for the manufacturer. Does it make iPhones also cheaper for Indian consumers because they are being made in India and then they will be sold in India?
Yes, for sure.
What would be the difference?
So one can easily assume that Apple can easily pass, if they want, like 5 to 8% to the end consumers.
Do you see Apple moving more of its iPhone production to India in the coming years then?
I think so, because if you look at all the suppliers, their capabilities, so they can really expand. Until 2018, 2019, Apple had only 1% market share in India. So technically, if you have almost like 1% of your domestic share, you could not have done much, right? So I would rather say Apple is here at the right time, at the right place, because now their domestic demand in India is picking up. The demand for iPhones is huge. And it may be just a matter of time when this thing will expand to other categories like watches, iPad, Macs. And then they can look at scaling those things as well here in India.
Tarun Pathak, Research Director at Counterpoint Research, speaking to me from India. And that big event of Apple's next series launch of phones will be covered in our next edition of World Business Report. Now, to Africa, where the deadly Mpox virus has spread across 14 countries there, killing over 500 people. Africa's Center for Disease Control is the main body trying to fight this outbreak and has now asked for more investments from international donors for it. So I spoke earlier to the man who's in charge of Mpox response about what kind of funding is needed and how it'll be distributed. Dr. Jean Kaseya.
We are looking to invest in a number of areas. First area is really to support our surveillance system and the laboratory capacity. The second pillar is to support the local manufacturing of vaccines, medicines in Africa. We are ready for that and we need to push. The third area is to support research and development.
How much money overall? What kind of package of investment are you looking at?
We are looking for, what you said, $600 million.
Has this money now been given to you?
No, not yet. We started to engage our partners because we believe that if we can get at least 10% coming from member states, African member states, it would be a key success. And from our partners, we are calling for solidarity. We say Africa needs you because you also need a safe Africa to protect yourself.
Who decides how is this money distributed?
We have partners who are implementing the program. It means if today we get some money for logistics, like a supply of vaccine, we know that this money will go to UNICEF. For the $600 million we are talking about, the cost of vaccine is not included because for us, and while we are negotiating with manufacturers for the cost of vaccine, we wanted that to be in-kind donation for countries. It means if we need to add the cost of vaccine, We are talking about a plan that will be not less than $1.6 billion.
Now, this again throws the spotlight on the questions on affordability of vaccines when such outbreak happens. What can be done about it?
Yes, if you go to the US CDC website, the vaccine is costing $270 per dose. $270 per dose. Let us agree that African countries cannot afford to buy this vaccine with that cost. This is why, when we started to negotiate about the transfer of technology to African countries to manufacture the vaccine, we are expecting that we can break that price and to have it less than 10% of what is applied today. We are expecting the price for each dose to be less than $15 to $10 in Africa.
Even with the technology that they get. But what kind of funding will be required to scale up vaccine manufacturing capabilities in Africa then?
We are expecting that having a total of $2 billion will help us to move forward with a basic program. Then we can see how to scale up later. And currently, we have around six, seven countries that are ready to start to manufacture a vaccine.
From where we are now, do you have a timeline with which you're seeing mpox outbreak this time, when it can be contained?
My hope is to see in the next 6 months, it means by January, February, to stop with that trend and to stop with this outbreak. But if after 6 months we don't stop the trend of this outbreak, I think we could face a major issue in the future.
That's Dr. John Kaseya, Director General of Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention, there talking to us. Now, as we've reported many times here on World Business Report, migration is an issue that affects the whole world, not least here in Europe, where many migrants try to move to looking for a better life. Now, Italy is one country which has seen an influx of migrants in recent years. Monfalcone is a port town in the far north of the country, which is seeing tension simmering between locals and migrants. This town has seen many migrants coming from Bangladesh to work at a shipyard, which is owned by a company called Fincantieri, but it hasn't always been easy for them. The town's mayor now has banned cricket and even imposing a fine of 100 euros to those playing the sport within the town limit, saying that Bangladeshi immigrants who play it as foreign and incompatible with local culture. I spoke earlier to Sunny Bian. He is a Bangladeshi migrant who came to Italy 18 years ago, worked at the shipyard, and is now a city councillor from the opposition Democratic Party.
Monfalcone has 32,000 current population, and most of them are migrants workers. And approximately Bangladeshis are 9,000 who are living here among Falcone. And most of them work in Fincantieri. So, and most of them lives with their families, and they bought houses, apartments here, and they have rented more than 1,500 apartments here also. So you can understand how Bangladeshi community contribute socially, economically, and also they work that type of works. Those work so many Italians don't want to do because working in shipyards, it's too hard.
Now, you've said that Bangladeshi workers are very important for the local economy. Then why is they are facing restrictions, especially when it comes to playing cricket, for example? The mayor of Monfalcone has said there is no space to build a pitch and cricket balls pose a danger. So she has put restrictions on playing cricket in the town. Earlier also, she's banned collective prayers at two Islamic centres. They're saying there are urban planning issues.
You know, she is from Lega. No, the politics of Lega is like that.
So you're saying it's because of the politics of the far right party in Italy. How is it being seen by the community?
This is putting us in social imbalancing, you know. The young people, the second generation or third generation, they're Italian by born, you know. And they feel like discriminating is like when you work in shipyard, everything is good. Everything is nice. There is no discrimination. There is no problem. The problem begins
when you quit your job and outside, when you come in social life, here, there the problems come. In social media, here, there, everywhere. So many people who were silent and they are starting to tell people, go now, enough, you go your country. We are facing also the way they see us. I have been living here from 18 years. I perceive this type of racism.
Are people packing their bags and saying, we don't want to work here?
Not happened yet, but I know so many people who were living here, Amon Falcone, trying to change their house to live in other communities, other municipalities nearby.
You want businesses who are there, who are getting these migrant workers to work for them, to do more?
Yes.
What can they do?
They can construct new houses for popular houses. It's called, they can make more schools. And when they see there is a discrimination, because these are peoples, not the slaves. So they have to ensure their fundamental rights also. Because if any child wants to play, they have to have this right to play. If anyone wants to pray, they have to have this place to pray. And Fincan Theory also have to ensure these things.
That's Sunny Bian, Bangladeshi migrant in Monfalcone in Italy. More on the story by Sofia Battista on BBC.com.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys, Season 2, The Disciples, and Season 3, The Apartheid Killer, are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, let's bring our markets guest, Rachel Winter, back in. Now, Rachel, I want to talk about the other news, which is from the European Commission publishing a report today calling for 800 billion euros worth of investment to drag the bloc out of industrial stagnation. Former Italian Premier Mario Draghi has written it. He's at the launch.
We have to understand we are becoming ever smaller relative to the challenges we face. For the first time since the Cold War, we must genuinely fear for our self-preservation. And the reason for a unified response has never been so compelling.
Rachel, that's a lot of money, and the words that the industrial stagnation has set in the Eurozone by Mario Draghi. Where do you think they need to focus?
Well, I think overall the growth in the EU has been very disappointing over the last couple of years. If we look back at the most recent quarter, the growth in GDP was only 0.2%, so it's barely above zero, so I can see why the concern is there. I think technology would be a good area to focus on, because that is an area where I think most countries outside of the US have really fallen behind. I think technology companies have really driven the growth of the global stock market in recent years, and I think the EU and the UK are really lacking in those big tech companies.
And this additional investment that Mario Draghi is asking for, how far can they take the Eurozone out of this kind of challenge?
Well, it depends how well they spend the money. I believe he's actually calling for 800 billion per year to be invested into the EU. I think if they spend it well and it encourages further investment after that, then it could make a big difference.
Also, where it'll come from is the big challenge. But Rachel, thank you so much for joining us. That's Rachel Winter, investment manager at Killick and Company. Now, on Tuesday evening, U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump will go head to head in their first TV debate. And we are counting down to it. And on those TV screens across America, both Republicans and Democrats are spending billions of dollars on commercials. The total for this year's race to White House is expected to exceed $10 billion. Russell Padmore has been exploring this in today's Business Daily.
1955, and President Dwight D. Eisenhower meets the press.
Motion picture cameras join newspaper reporters in the old State Department building for an historic presidential press conference, the first ever filmed in sound by newsreel cameramen.
In the mid-1950s, the U.S. leader realized he could use the fairly new medium of television to get his message to voters. A decade later, in 1968, President Lyndon B. Johnson shocked the nation live on television, saying he wouldn't stand for re-election.
I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Fast forward to July 2024, and American political history repeats itself.
So I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation.
President Joe Biden gave in to pressure from senior politicians and supporters of his Democratic Party to stand aside, allowing Kamala Harris to fight a campaign against Donald Trump. Millions of dollars have flooded into the Democrats' campaign, matching the Republican war chest and underlining predictions by several media intelligence groups that more than $10 billion will be spent overall, and most of it on buying airtime for political advertisements on television. Larry Magid, the chief executive of Connect Safely, is also a long-serving contributor with the CBS TV network.
Television advertising is all about image and emotion. Create a compelling story to grab your emotional attraction to the candidate or repulsion to their opponent. Whereas online, I think, can be more to a call to immediate action. For example, click here to donate money or to find out how to get to the polls. You have to buy exposure, and the more exposure you get in a positive way, the more likely you are to win. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the one with the biggest checkbook is necessarily going to be the winner.
Political advertising can also be produced by lobby or campaign groups.
Every woman has a right to defend herself with a gun if she chooses. Don't let politicians take away your right to own a gun.
The National Rifle Association spent $6 million getting that message broadcast in 2016. Natasha Lindstedt, a professor of American government at the University of Essex, says the money spent on political advertising is escalating with every campaign.
The last election, 2020 presidential election, $14 billion was spent just including the senatorial and the House races, but that was double the price tag of the 2016 election. So I would imagine the 2024 election is going to be the most expensive in U.S. history.
Finest foods are chosen.
Yeah, all the freshest foods are frozen by Snow Crop Frozen Foods.
An advertisement from the 1950s for Snow Crop orange juice. And it seems marketing campaigns from the past have lessons for the creative teams behind today's political advertisements. They're selling a brand, as Alison Stewart Allen, the chief executive of International Marketing Partners, explains.
Whether it's marketing a political candidate or a supermarket consumer good, you have to be super clear how you're better or different than the competition. And if you don't articulate those key points very clearly in ways that resonate with people, then you will not get traction.
The campaigns of both parties are also using artificial intelligence to target voters, notably tracking the sentiment of people in swing states. Robin Porter is the head of political at LoopMe, a company which provides advertising technology based on artificial intelligence. So what have you found? Why so much money is being spent on television when we live in the digital age?
Traditionally, the majority, over 80%, has been spent on traditional media, broadcast first, followed by cable, so more of those linear platforms. But in just this year, we're seeing the projections for streaming TV, or that digital space, is going to be up 600% from 2020.
That's Russell Padmore. You can listen to the entire program on Business Daily, wherever you get your podcasts. And an interesting online article, if you are looking for one, bbcbusiness.com has ASOS shoppers hit out at the new returns charge. So online shopping platform ASOS is saying to its UK customers that they will now have to pay nearly £4 if they keep less than £40 worth of items. Now, this is directed at a small group of UK customers with a frequently high return rate whose shopping habits have made it difficult for the company to save margin. So if you're returning any item less than £40, think again on this platform. That's it on World Business Report. Thank you for joining us.
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy needs to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC.